As ecological and economic justice movements hit the same hard limits of possibility, being realistic today means getting serious about what might have formerly been impossible, actually replacing our broken corporate capitalist system. Today, we're talking about how we begin to build together for the systemic change we need to save both democracy and the planet. Hello, everyone. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. So let's get ready to think outside the box, like think outside the big box, big time. As big as thinking replacing corporate capitalism, why we need a next system, and just what that system or those systems would look like. Our guest for this next hour is Gar Alperovitz. Gar is the co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative and co-chair of the Next Systems Project. As a political economist, author, former legislative director in the House and Senate, nonprofit innovator and scholar, Gar is going to share with us breakthrough and, safe to say, revolutionary models for community-based political economic development and new institutions of community wealth ownership. We're also going to spend some time talking about his recent book, What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. Gar, it really is an honor to have you here. And I said to you off air that the challenge in preparing for this interview, you're not a Q&A guy, in my opinion. Like, ask the question, Gar answers it. Your big, bold ideas in all their finest. And what I'd like to do is just ask a couple of questions and then you take as long as you want to answer, because I told you at Bioneers, Meredith and Kelly and I were very frustrated because all of a sudden you said, well, I see from the clock I'm running out of time. And we all look at each other and said, what? And we were those people in the seats that you were pointing out. So it's like, yeah, you said, I mean you. And Kenny's introduction of your presentation at Bioneers, he really set the stage for what today's distribution of wealth looks like. And it's really daunting. It's depressing until he shared with us, like he brought us really down. And then he brought us really up by telling us what you're doing. And I'd love for you to start the presentation with the bad. What is it like? How broken is our system as a whole? Where do you even start with that question?
Well, thanks for the more than generous introduction. I think most people understand someplace in their hearts that something's going wrong in the American system, and indeed in many parts of the world. But if you kind of probe to it, one of the things that's somehow out of kilter is the top 400 individuals. There are 300 million individuals in America, but the top tiny 400 have got more of America's wealth than the bottom 180 million people. Now, somehow that's out of kilter. That's one way to look at it. If you look at the trends in the ecological world, as many, many people know, we're having a real danger in terms of climate change, and no solutions seem possible. Other people, particularly racial and Hispanic groups, you find the numbers are way off the charts again, and things either get worse or they don't change much. So something deeper is going on that keeps the trends and the concentrations of income and the ecological problems what they are or getting worse, somehow in the architecture of the way the American system and many other systems is designed, keeps things as they are or getting worse. So that's simply an observation. And it can be made in clinical terms, as I was just trying to do, or what political scientists sometimes say, the architecture of this system, in architectural terms, how is it designed to produce those kind of outcomes. Or you can put it in kind of moral terms. Is it right that so few should have so much and so many should be struggling at the bottom? Or that somehow the way we organize our economic life destroys the environment, produces potentially cataclysmic climate change? Is that right morally, particularly if you think about the next community, our own children who are going to inherit that world? You can talk about it in different ways, but it comes down, I think, to What is the design of this system? People don't think about it that way. But one way to ask is, how is it designed, the political economic system? What are its pieces? And can we think about different practical pieces that can be put together like a different puzzle in a way that produces more equitable or more environmentally sustainable outcomes, more human kind of moral outcomes, even more community? And so that's, I think, one kind of very broad way to open the discussion.
And when I think of systems, and was like I said, it took me hours and hours because I kept starting and stopping and starting and stopping and a lot of thinking in between, because I think about in my everyday conversations in our state and in many states across the country, I would say the education system is broken. The prison system is broken. The mental health system is broken. The you name a system, you know, let's talk about the healthcare system. These are big picture systems, but then you can break it down to the micro, where even a system of where we used to have neighborhoods, community neighbors. We didn't all have fences with our doors closed and with, you know, our shades drawn. The system of community, right down to the micro, it's not all broken in that conversation, but these are some of the systems you're talking about. I didn't even mention the banking system. We're going there. I thought I have this expression where I say this just in, and I thought we should call our country the United States of Corporations or something like that, because that's a lot of where we are. But then you go on in your conversations and in your writings and in the work you're doing to talk about what just got me. An irreversible foundation for transformation. So how do we start to even begin to lay that down? And think of each of those words, an irreversible foundation for transformation, because we've got to turn this very screwed up ship around. And there are examples that you gave in periods of our history that establish a basis for transformation. You talked about the founder of Earth Day and how he got elected. You talk about the civil rights movement. So this is, you know, you're going to have many GAR moments to just talk about some of those foundations that we can build on.
Well, let's go to the elements that you can build on. But the first thing to say is that large-scale systems, the American capitalism, if you like, or state socialism, really revolve a lot about and around who owns most of the wealth. So it's important to start at that level and then come down to very practical things that I think are the only way to go forward. So in the feudal era, the kings and the churches and the major owners of capital, the lords, had all the wealth, and mainly it was land. And that meant they had the power because they had the landed wealth. In modern capitalism, it is people who own big corporations or own a lot of stock, and they influence politics, they influence the environment. These are things people know. In state socialism, the state had most of the capital, and it was controlled in bureaucratic ways. So it's very important. Most people understand that if you've got a lot of wealth, you probably have a lot more influence, and systems are designed that way. The problem we have in the American system is it's highly concentrated ownership of corporations and private wealth, and there haven't been designs, certainly nobody wants traditional socialism, state socialism, so there haven't been designs, people haven't thought about it as a problem in design. What would be a way, starting at the bottom, that begins to change who owns the wealth and who has the power, so that you build community, so that you build fairness, so that you build ecological sustainability, so that you began to have real democracy because things weren't so concentrated at the top. And if you start at the bottom, you can, and this is one of the things one of our projects, the Next System Project, has been doing, you can look around the country and see the beginning points, very practical, of a different system. Let me give you an obvious example. The ordinary cooperative, which is one person, one vote, ownership of a grocery store or a farm or a bank, and most people are members of a credit union. There are 3 million people who are members of credit unions. That's a one person, one vote bank. People don't usually think about it that way, but it's a very democratically owned bank, rather than most banks in the United States are owned by very, very few people who have a lot of wealth. credit union is an obvious example of a different systemic element, financial element, that you can begin to think about in a very different practical way. The banking system is quite interesting because there's an enormous amount of excitement going on at the local level in banking. If you go up to North Dakota, which is a very, very conservative state, there is a bank there that's been in operation 100 years. It's a state bank of North Dakota, and it's owned by the state. And it's very, very popular. You could call it a socialist bank if you like, because it's state-owned in this very conservative state. It's been there 100 years. It produces better outcomes, more profits, very popular among small business and farmers and cooperatives and business people in general because it does a better job at lower cost. But you could think of that as an element as compared with some of the big Wall Street banks where the concentration of wealth and power is extreme and also quite reckless, got us into a major crisis 10 years ago, which we almost didn't get out of. But that gives you a kind of picture. How would you build up the banking system, for instance? And indeed, there's a lot of people working on that in the Next System project we're involved in and in other places around the country. What would it look like if we started with the local credit union and then built to a city-owned bank? There are maybe 10 cities in the country now, I think maybe more now, saying, well, you know, we've got a lot of tax revenues. We could use that and build a city-owned bank that could help finance local small business, local cooperatives. And why should we pass the profits on to somebody else? We could fold those back in and reduce taxes. So many cities are doing that now. It doesn't get a lot of press, but it's developing. And also at the state level, like the Bank of North Dakota. Well, some things are too big for either credit unions or city banks. Why don't we go to the next level and set up a public bank and save the taxpayers money and also follow the example of this very conservative state, North Dakota, and build a public bank there. There are about 10 states that are actively considering that now. So you can begin to see how to revolutionize, or evolutionize might be a better term. I like the term evolutionary reconstruction, building up new pieces at the lowest, closest to the people level in every sector. So banking is an obvious one where there's a lot of activity right now, and you can see how things might go forward. And we could go, if we have time, I'm happy to go into many other ways that people are doing this all over the country. There's a whole movement happening at piece by piece, kind of thinking about how to reconstruct and rebuild the American system as we go. The term that people use is evolutionary reconstruction, which is different from, quote, revolution, big bang. It's kind of slow development. But it's also different from traditional reform, which kind of keeps the institutions in place. It's like a big bank and says, well, maybe we can get them to kind of change their ways a little bit, reform. No, this is about changing who owns it, make it cooperative or public or city or neighborhood. But you do it in an evolutionary way rather than either kind of, quote, revolution or just trying to tinker around the edge with minor reform.
One of the examples I think about when you talk about that is in our state, one of the positives, and I live in Arizona, and there are very, very few positives. And I mean that sincerely. There's, regardless of your political affiliation, what's happening at our state legislature is beyond heinous. It's you start looking at who's controlling our entire state and our budgets and our judiciary and our education system, and it's actually scary. What's really positive is we have one of the most robust and fastest growing local first movements in the state, and we have been able to mobilize, to create communities in the cities and in the small towns, and that's where you can see what you're saying. It's like, you know, you make it about me. What do I see that you're saying that's applicable in my community? And local first is one of those examples because you invest in local businesses, the money stays in the community. We are big proponents of credit unions in local first. So you can see how that really works. But talk to me about one of the things that intrigued me and that I want you to talk about a little more is the Cleveland Project, the Evergreen Project in Cleveland. It's big. I think it's 40,000 people. That's a lot of lives that it has impacted. So can you tell us about that as another stellar example of real systemic change, evolutionary, what did you call it? I want to write it down. I'm paying too much attention. Evolutionary revolution.
Well, I say evolutionary reconstruction.
Reconstruction, okay.
Yep. It's neither just kind of tinkering around with minor reforms nor kind of blasting away with a revolution. It's
right.
Just what you're talking about, local first. And then if you have to go to a larger level for technical reasons, then you go to that level. But you don't go there unless you really have to because you want to keep it as close to the ground as possible. So it's a very good transition because the Cleveland model, or it's called the Evergreen Corporation, is a little bit larger than typical local first. And what it is, Cleveland's a city of a couple hundred thousand now, was much larger at one point. But in the there's one neighborhood of about 40,000 in which this occurs, so that's the scale. And if in that neighborhood, if you drew a line around the neighborhood, and just to make it kind of obvious and simple, and make that a nonprofit corporation on top of that line. So the neighborhood, there's a neighborhood cooperative corporation just for that neighborhood. It's easy to set up a nonprofit, and this one's defined geographically, like local. And attach to that nonprofit corporation cooperatives, worker-owned cooperatives. So now you've got a double-barreled, first it's a nonprofit corporation for the whole community, and then attached to it are worker-owned cooperatives. And then in the case of it's called the Evergreen Cooperatives. In this case, they're quite significant scale. One of them is a very large industrial scale laundry. And it has about 300 workers. And they service primarily hospitals and universities and nursing homes in the area. So that's one of the cooperatives attached to and subordinated to a community-wide corporation. Now, what makes it interesting, and I'll tell you about several other pieces of this puzzle, but that's one attachment. What makes it interesting, and as you listen to this, you can think about what could we do here? And many places are, in fact, following this model by saying, how could we apply it locally here? In that same area, it's a very poor part of Cleveland, there are three big institutions that have got a lot of public money in them. One is the Cleveland Clinic, a big hospital with a lot of taxpayer money in the health programs. Another one in the state is Western Reserve University, lots of public money. And another one is called University Hospitals, another hospital. And those big, big institutions with a lot of taxpayer money in them obviously buy lots of things. They buy food, they buy clothing, they buy furniture. They just have a whole laundry list of things, plus they need heating systems, they need energy systems, they need lighting systems. So one of the obvious things to do is say, you've got a lot of taxpayer dollars going in. Why don't we begin to focus them on local people, and in this case, on these cooperative workers attached to this nonprofit that's trying to build the community in general? And why don't we focus some of the purchasing power of these big, they're called anchor institutions, because in most communities it's very hard for these big, big things to move. We'll build the community, stabilize the job. This is a place with 20% unemployment and average family income of 20,000. We can use this complex to build jobs and then build a community culture and use what's already there to reconstruct, and that's the term I like. It's kind of evolutionary and reconstruction of the community so that we change in democratic ownership and change the distribution of wealth and income to these new cooperative forms and build up a new model, which is very straightforward, but it uses what's already there. So that's the Evergreen model, which is in many ways being replicated in different parts of the country and also in other countries. There's a big one going on in Preston, England, which has been taken up by the Labour Party in England, and indeed it's become a part of the National Labour Party program. So many cities are copying some of the things here, starting locally and not trying to go beyond. I always think you should not go to a higher level unless absolutely necessary. But if it is necessary, then you should go to that level. But start right at the bottom first. And that's a really good example of doing things that are, you know, quite large scale. One of the industrial scale laundries has 250 workers. The Evergreen has a greenhouse which produces 3 million heads of lettuce a year. It's a gigantic effort. And the the solar installation company does an enormous amount of work in the area. So they've started small, but they've become quite significant democratically, all are democratically owned, either by the workers or by the nonprofit community corporation or by joint ventures between them. And so we're changing the ownership of who gets to own wealth. At the same time, we're building up very practical, very American-style reforms.
But when you're talking about something on that big a scale, what kinds of things have to be in place? Like, I think about it, my background is in social services, and I manage large volume social service contracts all over the country. That's what I did. And talk about systems and the skill sets, the training, the educational pieces. Who do you bring to the table in a program, like a project of that scale that... Because there's lots of pieces that have to come when you have a 20% unemployment rate, probably an undereducated population, because that's how our system works in education. The good high-end neighborhoods get the good, highly compensated teachers. So how do you even begin? I know you can't go chapter and verse, but what are some of the players? Is it a partnership with government and the institutions and the private sector and a social service component? What does it look like to begin the mindfulness of creating that from the kernel of the seed to the reality?
Well, the most important thing, I think, is a different sensibility and imagination. Because people don't think about doing something like what I just described that's going on in Cleveland and Preston and many other cities. It's just not kind of something you think about. So the first thing is to get an idea that, hey, they're doing it over there in this very poor neighborhood in Cleveland, and I could name a lot of other cities. We're just ordinary folks. Why couldn't we do something like that here? So it's kind of like a wake-up call. It doesn't have to be that way. And by the way, we run into, it's very interesting because this is kind of changing the ownership of wealth and democratic ownership, right? It sounds very radical. We get a lot of businessmen who are retired who want to help.
Right.
Why? Because it's very practical. It creates jobs and changes ownership and different work patterns. And, you know, it is not rhetorical, yet it is a different design. It's not big private ownership of the corporations. It's very democratic ownership. But the name of the game is let's get practical and start building from the bottom up in ways that benefit the community in some form of cooperative and democratic way. And as I said, once you get beyond the rhetoric and say, how do you do this? You find very interesting ideological things get out of the way and people start rolling up their sleeves to questions like how to, rather than big debates about rhetoric. So we think there's a lot of skills available. And there are lots of young people, there are lots of academic people, and lots of activists who once they think about it this way, begin to see a very different path forward.
And I think it all starts with, to kind of answer my own question in another way, is it doesn't start with a formula. It starts with a framework, because each community, the one in England won't look exactly like the one in Cleveland, which won't look exactly like the one, you know, wherever, upstate New York or wherever it happens to be. So what I love about what you support is the concept of community, of having people's voices be heard, of all players having a seat at the table. So there's not a formula, but I think it's safe to say there's somewhat of a framework when you take these models that speak to scalability. And another one, I want to tell you this and then ask you a question about it, because I love Zingerman's as an example, the deli in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I've interviewed them for the show. And what those two founders decided is that instead of going the McDonald's route, they wanted to create just a plethora of microcosm of businesses within the Zingerman's umbrella, and they made it employee-owned, and they allowed employees that got to the top level in their organizations to start a bakery, to start a cheese shop, to start a gift shop, to start, you know, the beat goes on. So my question is, I mean, that's a wonderful example of how that created a sustainable and socially just community in that area. And my question is, for one like that, which is more on the private model, is it the people that drive that change? Because if you are about greed and more for me and being in the top 400, that thought is not possible. Is there a part of this where the human beings that you gather have to have some level of buy-in and social justice sense? Does that long question make sense to you, I hope?
Well, no, it's a good question. And Zingerman's is wonderful. I love it.
They're great. I love those guys.
Yeah, it's a great place. It's a great model. But I think it turns on more than almost anything, because I think most people, there are obvious exceptions, have a positive vision in their hearts. They'd like to do good. They don't quite see ways to do it often and don't see a way to break through. So what's really interesting about beginning, we'll have to talk about getting to bigger kind of institutions, like what do you do about big banks and big industry, and we'll come back to that. But at the local level, once you begin to see these models emerging elsewhere, what they say to you is you can't sit here and say nothing can be done. It breaks that. And it says, yes, you can do things. Look, they're doing it in many, many communities across the country. If you go to our Democracy Collaborative website, we keep track of this stuff, of cooperatives and worker-owned companies and land trusts, neighborhood land trusts and public utilities. And there's just a ton of stuff going on at the local level, which the newspapers, which are in bad shape financially, just don't report on it. They don't have the staff anymore. But there's stuff going on all over the country that you can learn from. You can do it locally because they're doing it someplace else usually. And if you go to our website, or many places are now reporting on this, there are things to do. And that's really important, because my experience is that what stops people from acting is they don't believe anything real can be done. And if you can challenge that by saying, hey, they're doing it in Cleveland, or they're doing it in Youngstown, or they're doing it in what's happening in the banking system in California is going to be changed radically over the next year or two. If you go to, with Washington State, we're seeing the same thing. The governor of New Jersey ran on successfully on the ticket of doing a state bank. He's a Wall Street guy, but he says we ought to use the banking kind of model that'll help the state most. And you begin to see just below the level of national rhetoric all the things you could do if you wanted to. And that changes everything, because then it becomes, but can I really do that? And then it puts the ball right in your court and says, do you want to play or not? Rather than nothing can be done. That's the big revolution going on in this country right now, that the people are beginning to see, quite apart from politics, which is another track, that you can begin building locally if you actually open up, learn about something that's being done elsewhere that you could build on or copy or improve. So that's the most important and very exciting thing that's happening around the country.
And it shifts the paradigm. We all have books that were life-changing, and we're going to talk about where you got the name of your book in a bit, which I thought was fabulous, in a way kind of sad, because it was with Tolstoy and how things were then. And I thought, I wonder what he'd be writing about now about Russia. But well, we won't leap to that right yet. But what I was thinking about in really taking big, deep pauses to think about the impact of your work and the work of others is, one of the books I read that changed me was, it was called The Yin and the Yang of Climate Change. Not a New York Times bestseller. Someone, publishing company, sent it to me and asked me to read it and have the person on the show. But what it said, Gar, is that we like to say, oh my gosh, look at those big companies polluting the air, or look at big ag, pesticides, insecticides, polluting our rivers and streams. We like to put the climate change conversation anywhere but inside of starting with us.
Right.
And this man got me. I mean, he got down into my core and said, climate change is an inside job. You start looking first and foremost at your own behaviors, at your own carbon footprint, at your own purchasing, habits. And it really shifted my life. It's like, yes, I might not be able to control how much pollution Ford Motor Company puts in the air, or a coal factory, but I can impact what I buy and how I buy it, and impact the energy I use. And you you made us almost feel uncomfortable in our seats in a good way, because you looked in the audience and you said, yes, I mean you right in that seat right there. You said, get down to your own personal choices to start different conversations about how we actually participate as citizens changing the system. Because if not us, who else, right? If not we,
exactly.
Who else? And that got to me. I mean, I was taking copious notes and saying, yeah, you're right. It's like, get up, get on your feet, get up and make it happen. But let's go back to what you said about, I thought of things like, what do you do when it comes to something like the airlines or the railroads, bigger systems that are really dependent on them in significant ways, and many of them make huge profits. So how do you look at a system like that for any possibility of a design change?
Well, let me just say a word about what comment on what you said, because I think if people starting at the community level and begin thinking in the way of, you know, as I often say, you want to do this stuff, get a half a dozen friends together and sit down and start finding out what's being done elsewhere. And there's lots of sources of books I write, or lots of people are writing about this online. And then how could we help each other locally to do something that's been being done all over the country? That's the bottom line about responsibility and talking to. But then once you begin to get into the modality that, hey, there's a lot that's going on that we could do building from the bottom up, you begin to think about, well, supposing a bunch of us got together and other communities as well, what do we do about bigger stuff in this state, for instance? And California is an interesting example, because the state banking system and the state energy system, which is possibly implicated in the fires they've had because they've underinvested, many things going on. It's not a big leap when you say, okay, let's look at the local energy system. What could we do with solar? What could we do with wind? What could we do with a public utility here? Many, many things that can be done. We could go to the next level of the state and think, how would we reform that in the same direction to help what the communities are doing? And if you, my view is stay at the lowest level possible, but go up only if necessary, and then go up if you have to. And you begin to think about how we could change the levels of the system from the bottom up over time. I think of it as evolutionary reconstruction, building up. And then you say, some of the big things are going to have to be turned into public utilities. It's a very American concept, but so if you've got a really strong localist base, and if you think first locally and then only go up if you have to, well, in some areas you do have to go up. But with a good democratic base, you can control the bigger things that are made into public utilities, or, you know, all over the world, for instance, airlines are very commonly owned by the public government. They're like public utilities in most parts of the world. So airlines might be something that ought to be under a public utility idea nationally, but only if necessary go up to that level. And once you begin to think that way, and what's exciting to me is that lots of people are thinking that way, go up only if necessary, you begin to think about your kind of whole changing the system in some way that doesn't look like, well, we're going to kind of regulate the big guys, but, you know, we know they're too powerful to really regulate, or we're going to have a explosive revolution, which is going to produce something maybe worse. You start thinking, how do we actually work our way up, learning practically as we go to the next level? How do we do that? One of the states that's really interesting in this regard, and kind of just to give you an idea, two states I want to kind of give you an idea about going to the next level. One is Nebraska, which is a very conservative state. Most people don't know that the entire electrical system of Nebraska is all public utilities, no private utilities at all. And it's because somebody, you know, 70, 80 years ago began thinking about it and building from the bottom up. And so the prices are better, the pollution is better, and it's an entirely publicly built system in an extremely conservative state, just like the Bank of North Dakota in a very conservative state. So you begin to see that. The other one is Alaska. And I think some people know about the Alaska Permanent Fund, but people are talking about a guaranteed income, and it sounds really off the charts, and it's usually a left-wing proposal. Well, Alaska is a very conservative state, certainly not a left-wing state. They have, for 40 years, had a guaranteed income from oil revenues. Every citizen, as a matter of right, gets part of the flow back from the oil revenues in the state. As a matter, it's just distributed that way and considered obvious and necessary. Why should it go to just to the people who own the big oil companies? Why don't we distribute that money to everybody? One person, one share. If you've got five kids, you get two parents and five kids. If you've got one person, it's one person. They all get an equal share. But these are it's a very conservative state, but it's kind of modeling interesting principles that could be built up for other states to a larger level.
What about, okay, so I get it. I mean, there are models that, and these things are scalable. When it comes to things like education, I'm just going to briefly tell you what happens in our state. So we have, I think, the most charter schools per capita of any state in the country. That was my last time I researched. It was been a while ago. And there's really the very good and the very bad of that. There are charter schools that are part of the public education system. They came out of necessity, if you ask me, because I worked in schools for many, many years, and they're fraught with problems, and underfunding is one of them. I mean, the beat goes on. The charter schools was a look at a new system, and from where I sit now, for the most part, it's a disgrace. And again, it's the very few, some of them that are elected officials in the state legislature that are making millions of dollars. Some of the owners are multimillionaires, multimillionaires that are making money from taxpayers' money and providing really great education through what I call creaming. I mean, they do not have, it's not free access to education at all. Parents are shamed. The stories abound. So how do you curate that or mitigate that or whatever? Again, is that the power of the citizens and you keep up-leveling the conversation? Because I think our education system in Arizona is broken and in many states. But how do you, without creating another system that's maybe equally as bad, how do the concerned citizens doing the right thing, as I would say, that's a judgment on my part, are things like the Next System Project or the Democracy Collaborative, which I'd like you to talk about, both of those, are there guiding principles? Is there a framework for or a design that makes it a livable, you know, compassionate, inclusive alternative system?
Well, you're putting your fingers on one of the really nasty and toughest kind of margin right now to deal with, which is the education system. A lot of it has to do with funding as well. And again, that has to do with the distribution of income and wealth.
Right.
So if you start at, I mean, what we're talking about, maybe it's useful to say, all these projects and building from the bottom up, in the way that kind of we've been going on in this conversation, and we could, you know, if you go to our websites, we can, there's just going on all over the country, lots and lots and lots of different projects of the kind we're talking about. You begin to think about a mosaic over the next 5, 10, 20 years, building up, you know, like the prehistory of the New Deal, building up from the pieces that then kind of become the developmental pieces of something much larger in terms of transformation. So that thinking about really building a whole culture locally or nationally or in the state, piece by piece by piece. So that's the larger frame. That doesn't mean you don't deal with emergencies right now.
Right,
but
right.
It's a sense of, yeah, what we're talking about is, you know, the top 400 people having more wealth than the bottom 180 million people. Something's wrong with that picture. So we're talking about big change over time in a way that is practical and builds and learns as it goes. But we are talking about big change. And locally, that's the same idea, that we're going to have to come up and deal with the education system in a different way. And a lot of it's about money, and a lot of it's about who's got the political power to control the allocation of education money. So there's a whole kind of practical question. How do you actually do better education, particularly with different groups that come from backgrounds that don't have all the resources to learn from? And then how do we finance it? Well, piece by piece, and there is no short circuit. There's no shortcut in terms of education. It's very rough in many communities to fight out these battles. But all I can say is that that's a piece of the fight. another part of it is, how do you change the local ownership and tax system that is financing the educational system? And then you get back to who owns the local wealth. And you begin talking about some of these models where you have a different kind of democratic ownership, which also impacts positively the tax base in a different way. So coming at education is, you're really right to raise it, but it's kind of the tail end of this system that is so concentrated in income, wealth, and power that it ends up with kind of system at the educational level. So what we are talking about is changing the system piece by piece by piece, so that the power base, the political power base, and the income and wealth distribution that gives rise to and controls other subsystems like education shift with you as you go. So I don't want to gloss this in a way that makes it an easy thing to do. But I do want to suggest that you can build if you want to build.
And your point of saying the one thing that you don't say is there's nothing I can do and it is the way it is and it's never going to change. To me, that is like the kiss of death for the change and a new democracy, that I just hope if those words come out of my mouth, it means I'm getting close to the end of whatever life I had, because that's the despair. And God help us if we turn to that chapter in the book. So another huge gar bucket, as I call them, that's going to be one of maybe your new taglines is, you know, I've got a, which gar bucket do you want me to talk about? But there's the democracy collaborative, big, big, big picture, and then the next system project. And I, like I said, when I was thinking about, I do a lot of Q&A, but with you, it was just like one big Q and then a big A for one, because this is, and I'm not trying to just like lavish praise on you. This is really important work that you're doing that inspires me, who covers some really dark, deep, depressing topics a lot about, you know, the impact of climate change. So I guess the best place to start is with the democracy collaborative and the bold thinking and the action around that to address systemic challenges. Talk about the democracy collaborative.
Well, you roll up your sleeves, and I often say get some friends together and you could almost do anything locally if you decide to do it together.
It's true.
It is true.
It is absolutely true.
It's, you know, let's say it again real calmly. If you actually wanted to do something locally, and some of your listeners, what you can do is call together half a dozen friends who probably are that way. You can read about or find out about books and online and the kind of things we're talking about, things that people are doing all over the country that you could do locally, that give you a start for something in education or economics or community building or wealth building or cooperatives, you name it. People are doing a climate change. And you could say, we could find out about that together. I often say get some pizza and some beer and sit down and read.
From locally owned breweries and locally owned pizza stores, pizza restaurants.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then say, well, let's learn about what somebody else is doing that we might do here together as a group. And let's do it and support each other. And that's how it's done, period.
It really is. And I got that. It's like, that really it is. If it is to be, it's up to me. All those pithy sayings that have lasted forever, it really matters. And you can see it in any community that you get connected to. You know, one person says, we've got to change this. And then they talk to another person. And I have to say this, mothers and women are good at bringing about systems changes.
Even
if you go to how Walmart carried organic milk, I got news for you. It wasn't a worldwide movement. It started in a little town where the only store they had was Walmart, and these women read about the importance of not having, you know, of having hormone-free milk, and all of a sudden, Walmart is really bowing to the pressure of mothers who said, you're my only store. You have to carry organic milk.
Exactly.
And it started with a couple of people. So I have a question about policy. There's always the ongoing debate about people movement versus policy changes. So from your perspective, to bring about widespread systemic change, do we need both? Do we need a strong EPA? Do we need a strong FDA? Where does policy making fit into this conversation about social change and systems changes?
Well, as you probably know, I worked in the House. I was I was the legislative director in the House and in the Senate for Gaylord Nelson, the founder of Earth Day.
Right.
And I worked on the international level and on UN matters and the government at one point. So I come out of that world in part. But I'm also a kid from Wisconsin, which is a very cooperative state. So that's another part of it. Look, ultimately, in very large systems, you also going to need policy. And you're going to have to deal with the big stuff, too. But it depends on what the vision is that's going into what becomes, quote, policy. And that really depends on what people begin to develop locally. So go back to this Cleveland model, where you've got these kind of complex of cooperatives, and the health system is buying from the cooperatives in order to build up more cooperatives, and the educational. There's a whole design, and it's a worker-owned companies. And, you begin if the Cleveland system begins to suggest a different way of thinking, that it ought to be more democratic, that the economy could be more democratic, and that we could use our resources in different ways, those principles can be applied at higher levels as well. So, look, we had 10 years ago, we had a big, big national crisis. The banking system collapsed, and Chrysler was nationalized. General Motors was nationalized. The big banks were nationalized. So was a big insurance company. That kind of thing is going to happen again. We can begin thinking about, okay, these really big units, some of them ought to be turned into public utilities. Some of them ought not to be. Some should be broken up. You can think creatively about what makes sense rather than you can't do anything. And the foundation of that is not some airy-fairy radical kind of rhetoric. It's applying principles that people begin to develop locally. So that if you begin building locally, you begin to see different ways to do things with the banking system. As I said, there's a whole movement to democratize banking all over the country right now. But it gives the idea of what comes first is, does this bank serve this community? Should the city tax money go into that bank and then be multiplied building cooperatives, for instance, like the Cleveland model? And you begin to see different principles out of what makes sense that can be applied at higher levels of larger scale. And I think that's kind of the way to think about what I call evolutionary reconstruction, which is no big crash bang revolution. And also not simply reform, meaning kind of hold the, nothing changes except you try to regulate a little better. It's kind of evolutionary development of the kind we're talking about, but moving from the local level to the state level, like Nebraska or Alaska or North Dakota, to take those states. And then, if necessary, I'm very interested in this big country talking about regional change. And there's some regional models we can talk about if we have time. Because how do you have democracy or participatory democracy in a 3,000-mile continent now at 330 million people? So decentralization is inevitable.
Right, right.
And so you need to think about that democratically. And you know, I think that's going to be one of the big changes over the next X years. But building from knowledge and working up to, you know, the next scale, but trying to apply these principles. So I think of it that way. I don't think of a crash, bang, kind of explosive revolution.
Right.
Who knows down the line that may or may not occur. It happens in lots of countries. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about building and learning from the bottom. And there's a lot of learning and building to do. And we're talking about decentralization and applying these principles and then seeing, you know, does that make sense? Would it make sense at higher levels of change? If there's a big crisis, like the big crisis we had 10 years ago, well, maybe some of those companies ought to be turned into public banks or public institutions. We can face that, too, and begin to talk about it. But let's take it step by step and learn as we go first.
And even with social change, if you look and reflect on, if you go to the Next Systems Project and you go down the rabbit hole and you see that you're talking with great minds and activists and using the best research and doing strategic thinking, there are examples in my community, in the many communities that I visit or that I interview people that are living in those communities about, it's just about what you're talking about. Our tagline is, we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And it's really about thinking and taking thinking to the next level to bring about these fundamental changes, because there are so many failed systems. So to me, a lot of the questions that I had, I started answering that there isn't one answer. There isn't one formula. There isn't one path to take. That's what was wrong What's right is that we have to look at what is the critical path that we have to take in this community. An example in our state is you can imagine the volatility in the conversations around sanctuary. And I will tell you, Tucson is saying, and with the blessing of some of our elected officials, Tucson is going to be a sanctuary city. And that's because the people in our community said, we're not doing that. We're going to offer safe refuge. We're going to open our homes and our churches and our institutions to give people who are seeking safety, we're going to give them sanctuary. And it's happening. Mm-hmm. And it, like I said, it is getting the blessing of some of our elected officials. And there's a lot of joy around that. But that's a systemic change at a local level that nobody can, you know, there's policies and people are choosing to ignoring them. I know we're going to run out of time, and even though I got Gar for an hour, I don't want to move on and conclude without talking about your book. And the reason is because your book surprised me. I think you can probably tell I'm pretty honest about my emotions, wear them on my sleeve. But I thought, oh my gosh, this is going to be a policy book about how to. Oh, and I've got to read it because I owe it to the guest. What I want to say is it's not that. It is so not that. I want to encourage people to do it. I want people, you talk about thinking outside the box. This would be a freaking awesome book for book clubs. When you talk about gathering people in conversation, I would much rather be in a book club that talks about being a part of the revolution. And your book, it's not dry, it's informative and fun and inspirational. You tell stories. What would you say to people about your book? That's what I said. That's a pretty glowing report, but there's a lot of people of things in there. And I do want to read a quote from Tolstoy, but what would you say about your book?
Well, it was mentioned, the title is called What Then Must We Do?
About the, What Must We Then Do? What then must we do? Straight talk about the next American Revolution. And let me go, segue. In the introduction, you say that you borrowed the title from Tolstoy and the profoundly disturbing book that he wrote in 1886 once he started to dig below what was happening in late 19th century Russia. And I want to read the quote because it really got to me. I sit on a man's back, choking him and making him carry me, he wrote, and yet assure myself and others that I am very sorry for him and wish to ease his lot by all possible means, except by getting off his back. Mm-hmm. And that was one of those, like, I want to do this. It's so cliche, but it's like, bam, that's not my problem. And I'm really sorry for you, but can you please keep giving me this at that really cheap price? And I'm going to buy the $5 t-shirt anyway. I mean, I thought of a bunch of examples where it's much more convenient for me to stay the course that I'm on than say, I really need to get off his back. I really need to.
Yeah, exactly. And not only that, but is there something practical you can do getting off his back? And that's the book is all about things being done all over the country, as well as some of the principles that might inform a larger systemic transformation. So thank you for bringing the book up. And it was designed, it's interesting because I come out of an academic background. And what the book is, it's called What Then Must We Do? And it's an attempt, and I say this, and a lot of my academic friends kind of frowned at me. I said, look, if I have coffee or drinks with another professor, we will talk the way everybody else talks. And we would talk about what's being written. And you could put it in language that that anybody can understand if you want to. So the book is, in fact, about some very large issues and complicated questions, but it's very much, I hope, down home. I often think I'm from Racine, Wisconsin. I often think my buddies I went to high school with, if I'm talking to them, they better understand it. It's my fault if they don't, not theirs. So that the book is written that way, but it's kind of informed by a lot of, you know, political theory and economic theory.
This will make you laugh. When you say Racine, Wisconsin, my mouth watered because of their pastries, which, by the way, you can now get in Trader Joe's. They are famous
Danish pastries.
For their Danish pastries. It's like you said that, I went, oh my gosh, why am I thinking that? And, you know, it always amazes me where you are a scholar, no question about it, and your ability to quote, because another one, I use red sticky notes and then put stars and exclamation points. But another one, which is really, it's so funny that I opened to this page when you were saying that, writing about the various strategies, a line from T.S. Eliot comes to mind. I got to use words when I talk to you, but if you understand or if you don't, there's nothing to me and nothing to you. And that's what you're talking about. It's like you really have to use what I call just common plain folk talk in order for people to grasp this and to grasp the importance of the next American Revolution, because you would have to be living in a cave or under a rock to not realize, I don't know how the revolution's going to end, but I tell you, you have to know that we're in the throes of a really big revolution. Old paradigms are exploding and dying and blowing up, and new ones are being born. Some are good, some are bad, but we are in the throes of it. And this book will kind of bring some sanity to the conversation. That's how I felt. And I didn't read every word, the whole thing, but I got into it far enough to know that I will finish it. And it'll be something that I take, you know, on my next vacation to have conversations, even with my husband and my kids, about continuing it. So
you're very generous. Thank you.
Well, I think it's very true. And, you know, we have about 7 or 8 minutes left. And I wonder what else you feel is critical that we cover or that we talk about.
Well, I think the thing that most people, I mean, why I wrote What Then Must We Do is most people don't think they can do anything.
I know, and I loved your message about that. You in the seat. I'm talking to you.
Yep. I think what people don't quite realize is that every, quote, revolution begins with a couple friends get together and have a beer and start talking about what could we do right here. And the second question is there anything we could learn from somebody else in some other town who's done something right here that they could do, and then see what comes from that. The biggest problem is people kind of looking at each other, well, there's nothing we can do. And the truth is, and that's what this book is about, because it's just reporting on what's happening all over the country, plus what some of the visions of larger scale would be. There's a lot, not a lot, there's an extraordinary amount going on in this country that's not reported on by the press. You just can't get to it. Unless you can go online, and you know the book gives you places where you can go online and find it, but it's not in common distribution, except there's tons of it in energy and education and health, in co-ops and economic development and climate change. You name it, there's a revolution building up at the local level where people can do things, and that's the basis of a bigger change. That's what's got to come first for big change. And in that sense, you know, given all the difficulties we're facing, I have an optimistic view of the longer haul. I think that we Americans have the possibilities to change the system in some powerful way if we kind of just roll up our sleeves and start doing it the way many, many, many people are doing. And what's exciting to me is there are now examples on the ground. Things you can no longer say nothing can be done. What you can say is, well, I'm not, they really don't want to spend time kind of opening a book or going online to find out what can be done. There are things in virtually every area: education, climate change, land use, housing, worker ownership, cooperatives, technology, you name it. Things are popping up all over the country that are the basis of a transformation as people get to learn more and more about it. So I'm talking to the person in your seat and in my seat because it's what's called an existential question. Am I going to do it? It's a choice question, not a, well, nothing can be done question.
And that puts it, I mean, that's a great note on which to end. And I do want to assure you that in our show notes and then when we've put out your podcast, all of the links to the, you know, all of the work that you're doing and the projects you're involved, there will be links on the websites to all of them, a link on how to get your book. And before I do the last words from Mrs. Green, I want to talk about our show on March 27th. It's the final show in our local series about Tucson Electric Power's Brighty Award winners. And it speaks to Gar's point so incredibly well about what's going on in our community here locally. And it's two colonels from the Arizona Air National Guard and what they have done in terms of not just energy efficiency and solar, but in a truly sustainable look at the work they're doing and the footprint they have. And then April 2nd, Jeff Clemens, he's president and board member of American Promise. American Promise Democracy Restored. And talk about a heavy lift. He and a group of people started working on the 28th Amendment of the Constitution and how they're going to bring that about, and they're making progress to really get big money out of our elections. So my last word is, in our world, Mrs. Green's world, we believe that we can never have a sustainable planet without a socially just one. And to me, Gar Alperovitz is everything that is right about the world from both perspectives. And it's not every day that I get to spend time with a visionary like him. I'm talking about you like you're not here, but I know you're listening, Gar. I was mesmerized by him and his message when I heard him speak. I went deeper and deeper into the work he has been doing with others, other thought leaders, other visionaries, other community activists. And he's doing it, and they are doing it for all of us as I researched his journey and his work. I feel as though Gar Alperovitz has my back and that he has all of our backs. My hope is that this podcast will inspire you in that seat right there, as it has me, to read more about him, to buy his books, to start your own conversations about the next American Revolution, and to investigate and learn about the work he and other thought leaders are doing that change things for the better, for you, for me, for our community, and for the planet. In short, Gar gives me hope that I might live long enough to be a part of a truly just and sustainable world that works for more than just the top 1% of our world. I feel so blessed that he has walked into my life, and I'm going to make sure he stays there. Thank you, everybody.